This is the State of Things from Triad Stage in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stasio. Well, how does a city remember a tragedy? 40 years ago, a caravan of Ku Klux Klansmen and American Nazi Party members pulled out weapons and killed 5 anti-Klan demonstrators in Greensboro. 10 people were injured. The police were nowhere to be found, even though the community later learned they had advanced warning about the attack. The Greensboro massacre was quickly buried in the national news cycle after the Iran hostage crisis began the next day, but it remains a painful moment in this city's history. Reverend Nelson Johnson is a survivor of the attack. He is executive director of Beloved Community Center and a member of the Greensboro Pulpit Forum, a ministerial group that is asking the city of Greensboro for a more formal apology. Reverend Nelson Johnson, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you.
And I should say we are live streaming this program on Facebook right now. You were one of the organizers of the anti-Klan demonstration and a planned conference. Tell us about the plan. What was being organized for that day?
It's just what you said. It was a march to a conference site where the conference was to discuss the rise of racism and in particular the role of the Ku Klux Klan in that. We were working in textile mills, a lot of it in Greensboro, but some in Danville and Martinville, in Hall River. We had just sent Sandy down to Kannapolis to work with Cannon Mills. And we were bringing together multiracial workers with the community, the African-American community that I worked in for about 12 years. And our march was gonna wind through that community and end up in another part of town, which was Freeman Mill Road and Florida Street. Incidentally, we lost the site that we were to meet at a day and a half before the march because a person who was a member of that church worked in the police department as a maid, I believe, some cleaning job. Told the pastor that the Klan were going to throw dynamite in the building and blow it up. So I didn't have a parade permit 2 days before the march, although I applied for it about 12 days before. The law requires, the policy at the time was 72 hours. So I had no parade permit. Then we lost the building. I worked to get another building, but I didn't share that with anybody because of the way things were developing. And I'll say this and then I'll let you ask some questions. I did call a press conference 2 days before the march because we had people coming from all over the state with no parade permit. I had pursued the police and asked them, but I couldn't get a good answer. Somebody said the police were out of town or the person was out of town. I said, what's the police doing out of town? So I finally decided to call a press conference. And I called the press conference. I feel we had been harassed. Our posters were being taken down. Police were following people who were putting them up. And as I was having the press conference, a police officer came out and gave me the parade permit. That's when I got it. Because my view was, give us the parade permit or tell us you're not going to give it to us. What I didn't know is that at the same time that I received the parade permit, an informant for the police who was a Klansman named Eddie Dawson also received the parade permit. So let me stop there. That was actually kind of what was leading into this on November the 3rd.
And these people, you said, you noticed people coming from out of town. These were Klansmen, these were other people who were planning some kind of demonstration. You're saying, well, look, if we don't have a parade permit, do they have a parade permit? I mean, that's what you're asking about, right?
Well,
whether they were being
no,
given
that's,
parade permits?
That's not a proper interpretation.
All right.
We had no knowledge of them coming to town to start with. The police had knowledge
right.
of it, but they didn't tell us. And we were actually planning to walk through the community.
Right.
We had a flatbed truck. We were mounting speakers on it. We had singers. We had bongos. And we were looking for a festive time. If you start with 200, you end with 400, when you have worked in the community and people recognize you. That's what we were planning for November 3rd.
Now, there was also a restriction that the city placed on you in order to get the permit, right? And that was to talk about that.
Well, Captain Gibson, with whom I met to get the parade permit, we talked through all of the particulars. I brought a copy of the parade permit with me. At the end of it, he said, you have to sign here that none of y'all will be armed, concealed, or open. And I asked him, do you know something that I don't know? Are you expecting something? He really didn't answer. He said, if you want the permit, then you have to sign. So I signed because we needed the permit. And actually, my mistake was really thinking that the police would be there. I had no idea that they weren't going to be there.
Because as we found out later, and we'll talk more about this, but they knew they were coming. The Klan informant had told them.
Absolutely. The Klan informant to whom they gave the parade permit had told them weeks in advance that they were coming. You don't know this because I don't share it that much, but I later met with a Nazi named Roland Wayne Wood. And he told me that the BATF agent, Bernard Bukovich, who he thought was a superior in the Nazi organization, ordered him to come to Greensboro and to bring all his men and all the weapons, or he would get demoted as a Nazi. I was sitting along with Signy. He was on his deathbed, in a sense. He was in a convalescent place, and he shared this with me during the truth process.
BATF, Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, Federal Bureau.
Exactly.
Who are supposed to regulate and enforce these laws. So talk about what happened then on November 3rd, the day of the march.
Well, it was a foggy morning, and the fog was clearing, and we were in Morningside Homes. There were also some people at Windsor Center. Actually, the march was a late addition. The conference was what we were planning. And it was my suggestion, having worked in the community, let's march through the community and bring more people from the community. So that was an add-on. One of the things I feel bad about was the slogan, Death to the Klan. I think that was a mistake. However, that was not the name of the march. I have the name of the march on the parade permit. It says an anti-Klan march. The system renamed the march in order to prop up the sensationalism. Well, we were pretty much singing and doing what people do, put posters together and so forth. When the Klan vehicles started to come in, I saw the Confederate license plate and recognized it. In the lead vehicle, I saw the man who was at the press conference, who was Eddie Dawson, who got the parade permit. He was leading the whole thing. And there was a young person that I later learned was named Buck, who was sitting on the passenger side. He fired a pistol in the air out of the window. All of this nonsense about who fired the first shot is just nonsense. I saw who fired the first shot, and people ran away from it, and people jumped out of their vehicles, and tussles started. There was some shouting. Some people did hit the Klan car with their hands and with sticks. But I was charged by a Nazi with a long butcher knife, and he tried to come up and hit me. I put my arm out. I blocked it. It went through my arm. I can't lift this finger now. So I didn't see most of what was happening because I was fighting there. When that was over, I ran across the street to see where the shots were coming from. I saw bodies laying around, and I saw the vehicles beginning to leave. I went over and I saw Sandy slumped against the building. She was the president of student government at Bennett, beautiful black sister. Her mother brought her to us and she lived with us and was like a sister to us. I then saw other bodies. I went over to Jim, who was shot in the back and was laying face down. I turned him over and he took the last breath. Air just came out of him. I knew at that moment, I didn't know the details, some of which I'm sharing with you, I knew at this moment that that could not have happened without the participation of the Greensboro police. And I stood up And with all the energy and feeling I could command, I started to say that. The police screamed in with sirens bursting and ordered me to shut up, and I refused to shut up. I kept saying what I intuitively knew to be the truth. At that point, the police grabbed me, wrestled me down, and took me to jail. And I didn't know who was exactly dead or who was alive, except Jim. And so I was in the hospital for a short while. I was bandaged up and taken to put in jail on the $15,000 bond.
On what charge?
Causing a riot, I think, or something to that effect.
You were arrested, but the Klansmen and Nazis got away.
Well, a lot of them did, but they stopped one of the cars, and they did arrest them.
Talk about, and you said that you weren't able to see much of what was going on. You were having to defend your own life at the moment, but court records would later show that the Klansmen and Nazis were using shotguns and rifles that had been in their trunk. So while it was a handgun that was fired initially by a Nazi or Klansman that touched off the shooting, they were using shotguns and rifles.
Precisely, and I should have won a picture we have with all of those guns that were retained. They opened the trunk of their cars and fired oftentimes leisurely at people. And Jim shot in the back, Caesar shot through the heart, Bill shot through the heart. These were good organizers around the state. So I came to the conclusion not only that this could not have happened without the police, but the police were active collaborators in what I now call a North American death squad. This was not some random shootout, that it was linked to stopping the campaign that we were involved with, and we were good organizers. My history before that was organizing victory after victory in the black community, bringing together the coalition, the NAACP, the Pulpit Forum, all these groups we worked closely with. In light of that, this coming together of black and white workers with a historically active black community was the objective to arrest that work. And I think and we got information that they had target practice without pictures in the woods, some reports we got. So we know that this was not just a spontaneous thing of people shouting and a fight broke out, that it was more than that.
Well, the police were not there. Did you find that strange? I mean, here's this parade route. They knew there might be, I mean, here's something that the police usually show up for, right?
And anybody who's ever organized a march know that the police are not late. They're on time. I shook hands with Captain Hampton. He was a lieutenant then. He said he would meet me there. He never showed. As a matter of fact, I've never seen him in Greensboro again. He's been the chief in three cities that I know of. How do you leave Greensboro? And they accused him of being out drunk or something like that, and two white men got in charge. I can't remember their names right now. No harm meant with that phrase. But that guy was no longer there. And two people who said they didn't know me and didn't recognize me, which is hard for me to believe, were then in charge, and they said they couldn't find where the starting point of the march was.
Well, and we should point out again, I mean, what's fascinating to me and what often gets overlooked in this tragic story is this was 1979, which may seem like a long time ago to a lot of people, but the fact is it's 1979, and you organized a march because of a rise of white supremacy. The rise of the Ku Klux Klan in 1979 America. And the police are complicit, which a lawsuit would later demonstrate. A federal lawsuit would demonstrate the complicity of the police with white supremacists in the city of Greensboro in 1979 in an effort to bring white workers and black workers together and end white supremacy. So I think it's fascinating to point that out, that the Ku Klux Klan is not at all a part of our deep, dark history, and violence is deeply associated with white supremacy, and in fact, it is an essential component of it. I want to talk more, too, about the efforts then, and we'll continue the conversation about the events, the legal fights afterward, but also attempts at reconciliation. I'm talking with Reverend Nelson Johnson, a survivor of the Greensboro Massacre, also executive director of the Beloved Community Center and a member of the Greensboro Pulpit Forum. Now I'd like to turn to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was an independent group trying to get to the bottom of what happened during the Greensboro Massacre. Spoma Jovanovich is a professor of communication studies at North Carolina UNC Greensboro, also the author of Democracy, Dialogue, and Community Action, Truth and Reconciliation in Greensboro. Spoma, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, talk about the Truth and Reconciliation efforts afterwards and the fact that, I mean, some people, I think, have the feeling, and I know Reverend Nelson Johnson, you've been outspoken about this, that this somehow was Reverend Johnson's idea. This is a large network, right?
Oh, right. Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question. You know, the survivors and their supporters for years had been trying to have some deep conversation about what actually happened on November 3rd, oftentimes wrapped around commemoration events, you know, 5th anniversary, 10th, 20th. Well, the latest idea that came up, and then this was in the early 2000s, was what about a truth and reconciliation process? And so they had not only a major group here, a local task force, which I think one of the things that's really important, is that was called the Greensboro Truth and Community Reconciliation Project. That word community was critical. And the community rallied around to say, yes, this is something we want to do. They were also in conversation with the National Advisory Board, with renowned people from all over the world, scholars, faith leaders, who also provided support, and launched this effort in earnest, I would say, in January of 2003, although preparations before that were well underway. And over the course of several years until the report came out in 2006, I would say there were thousands of people involved in this effort to get it going and to support and sustain it.
This is the early 2000s. Reverend Johnson, up until that time, what was the city saying about this event?
You know, I would not have believed that the city that I lived in for 15 years would have such a demonizing campaign. Articles were written that said that we wanted to get ourselves killed, that our work was failing, and we needed something sensational. And so my two daughters were there. And it was deeply painful to hear this and to listen to the radio where people said, I'm listening, we think he should have been killed. I wrote the mayor a long letter, John Forbus, and outlined a lot of things that were just wrong. But I got to a place I couldn't get a job here. I've sat in the court, and people got up off of the seat that I was on and moved to another place because they thought we were putting their life in danger. Richard Boland, who ran a restaurant, came to me almost weeping one day and said, I have to tell you that you and your friends can't meet here anymore. He was my friend. His father was my friend. And he said, because the insurance company threatened to pull the insurance if y'all keep meeting here. And so in some sense, there was a massive campaign to both demonize and isolate us. But in some sense, our roots here were too deep, at least mine was. And I was able to get to clergy and talk to people and pull things together. Let me say something quickly that leads into the truth process. Before that, Emily Mann brought a play here that was at UNCG. And one of the students who was an intern with the Beloved had his father come to the play who was on the jury. And his father, after the play, said, if I had known what I know now, I never would have voted to acquit the Klan. That's the level of confusion and disinformation that was unleashed on this city.
Our conversation about the Greensboro Massacre 40 years later will continue on the State of Things. First, the music of M. N. Tai.
Looking round, I can see. how to grow. See, down here we play the blues a different way. Bring a smile to your face on your worst day. It's the kind of sound that makes you say, hey, hey. Well, I ain't heard nothing about no bad news, baby. Well, I'm feeling all right.
I'm feeling
tonight.
All night tonight.
Yeah. Well, I've got a cure and it's gonna
save me.
Gonna borrow and make them all right. 'Cause I've got the Carolina blues on my side.
This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. This weekend marked the 40th anniversary of the Greensboro Massacre. In November of 1979, Ku Klux Klansmen and American Nazi members came to an anti-Klan demonstration, pulled out weapons, and killed five protesters. Police did not attend the march, even though they knew of the potential for violence. There is an official state historical marker commemorating the Greensboro Massacre, and the city council issued a broad apology for the city's role in the tragedy, but many feel local government has not done enough. Greensboro Pulpit Forum is asking elected officials to revisit what happened and provide an apology of substance. Still with me, Nelson Johnson and Spoma Jovanovic. Nelson Johnson is a survivor of the Greensboro Massacre, one of the organizers of the original event. He's the executive director of the beloved Community Center and the member of the Greensboro Pulpit Forum. Spoma Jovanovic, professor of communication studies at UNCG and author of Democracy Dialogue, at Democracy Dialogue and Community Action, Truth and Reconciliation in Greensboro. Spoma, just before the break, Reverend Johns was telling us about the effort to recast this story and retell the story of the massacre and blame the victims, as it were. A truth and reconciliation process is conceived and by the early 2000s developed. Talk about how that process was developed and what it was going to look like.
Well, here in Greensboro, I think folks took inspiration from what had happened in South Africa, but also in other places around the world, to look at what had those Truth and Reconciliation Commissions done and how did they do it. A big difference, of course, was here in Greensboro. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission was not started or supported, endorsed, or in any way connected with the government. And so this was the first time in the world where from the grassroots level, people said, we can do this. And I think that's really significant. So people learned about what had happened in other cities and then crafted a process that was, I think, took great pains to make sure that it was democratically structured. So for instance, when it came time to pick truth commissioners, one strategy was to have a selection committee of people representing virtually every aspect of the city. So somebody from the Republican Party, somebody from the Democratic Party, the colleges and universities, all the different groups, the police, the city, and they were to take in the nominees for truth commissioners and then make a decision. And I think it was really an important point Joyce Johnson made, this one, that people could look at the selection committee and say, there's somebody who represents my interests. I mean, no matter who they were. That's just one feature, but documents were drawn up, a process of having community conversations. What is truth? Was one of those conversations held at the library. What is reconciliation? How should people participate in this process along with the truth commissioners? And again, I think that, you know, the truth commissioners themselves had an extraordinary job to do, but the community also had a very important role to continue, you know, to support that work, to raise the awareness of what had happened and to make sure that the conversations in the community were going on at the same time that the commission was collecting information.
So this is not a tribunal that gets plunked down with the goal of finding guilty, not guilty, you know, a black or white answer. This is a commission that is in a process that's involving people developing the process as you go along.
Right. And I do think that that's something that, you know, all government could take a lot of lessons from. I mean, the stories were able to be told sometimes for the first time. time. There's certainly the survivors whose stories had been picked apart and chopped and used in ways that didn't have the full context. But also there were people in Morningside homes that had suffered and had never been able to tell their stories, out of fear, out of retaliation, out of also people not even asking them. So I think all of those came out and started to paint a much larger portrait of what had happened, at least for most people in terms of their understanding.
Now, all of this came out without the participation of the city as an official entity, right? The city refused to participate. So
right, despite petitions, you know, people collected thousands of names and said, you know, here, we want this, city, please, at least, I think there was at one point the hope that the city would be involved. And then when that didn't work, okay, how about just support the findings of the Truth Commission? No, we're not going to do that. I mean, at every step along the way, they refused to participate, finally saying they would read the report. And that took many, many years after the report was done, and quite a bit of, pushing. In fact, I think they were reading other reports and only the executive summary of the Truth Commission, which was hardly, you know, the depth, you know, there was a 529-page report. There was a lot of depth and richness in there that needed to be read and discussed.
Nelson Johnson, what was your response? I mean, were you surprised that the city, again, this would have been about 20 years or so later, that the city refused to participate in this?
Sadly, I was not. I wish there were time to document more completely what the city did to confuse, obscure, to demonize. A lot of it is in the letter I wrote to the mayor. But I was once in jail under twice the bond of Klansmen for one night. They just caught me and said that I was using profane language, which isn't against the law, which I don't do. I have to think to curse publicly. I wasn't brought up like that. But that gets in the paper and you get reflected that way. So we did struggle hard for the city to be involved, and the mayor pro tem, Yvonne Johnson, did get involved. And I'm proud to say that on Sunday night at Shiloh Baptist Church, she publicly apologized for herself and said she would try to get the city of Greensboro to apologize. So there's some crack in the armor.
What would it take? What are you looking for at this point?
We gave the city 7 points, and each one was very specific. I'll read a couple of them. The failure of the police and the city to be present to protect the marchers who had a legal permit from the planned attack that the police were well aware of. You need to say you apologize for that. The failure of the police and the city officials to warn the marchers of the extensive foreknowledge that they had that this was going to happen. And even one of the Klansmen came and pleaded with the city to cancel the march. They didn't cancel it, they didn't warn us, and they didn't show up. But there are 5 other equally strong points that we're asking the city to apologize. To say you apologize and not mention a single word about what you're apologizing for is childish. It's like the kid knocked the glass off the table. I'm sorry. And that's it. People need to understand what their city did and what the police did and what they did not do, because without that, how can you correct it? How can you actually correct the thing? And that's what we've been fighting for.
And again, none of what you just said is in dispute. All of that came out in the civil case that was won by
It came out in the civil case, and most of it is in the police report itself. These were not wise police people. They put it all in their own report. So it can't be questioned. They said all of this in their own report.
I want to bring Valerie Ann Johnson into the conversation now. She's the Mott Distinguished Professor of Women's Studies and Director of Africana Women's Studies at Bennett College, also a member of the North Carolina Historical Commission. Valerie, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Well, last night we talked about that city council meeting, and elected officials say that in some ways they've already apologized for the city's role in the Greensboro massacre. And as you heard Reverend Johnson say, it did not complete enough. Talk about where the city is in this and what the reluctance is, this, as far as you can tell, so many years later.
Well, from my perspective, and that is someone who works in the city and doesn't live in the city, so that I can step back a little bit in order to see what is going on and what happens here, is that that reluctance comes from not wanting to take the responsibility for the actions of their own organization, the police. And by admitting that there was some culpability, that there was a lack of action on their part that then helped foster what then later occurs, by not doing that, it doesn't allow for the healing to occur that needs to be done. You can't get past that stumbling block. And so in that way, and it also, I would ask this question, would be the financial concerns that many times municipalities have when they don't take responsibility for something. Will we be sued? Mm. What's going to happen, you know, financially because we've said and admitted something?
Is there, it also suggests anyway that there's some political capital involved here, that because you're talking about people who are no longer the chief of police, perhaps no longer even on the police force, some may be, but most are not, members of the city council who are no longer serving. In order to maintain this fiction that it was somehow not what it was, it suggests that you have a population, or at least a subset of the population, that doesn't want to hear the real story.
Oh, absolutely. There are people invested in a particular vision of what Greensboro is and was. And the reluctance to go forward is the reluctance to admit, no, it wasn't all that we could, that we propose, you know, that we promote in our various ways. And that resistant component is really difficult to crack. But as Reverend Nelson Johnson said, it was healthy for Yvonne Johnson to say, well, I will take this back. It's a small step, but it's an important one.
What about the process, Reverend Johnson itself, that did take place, albeit without the participation of the city? Was that therapeutic in its own way? And to what extent was that useful, or was it without the city?
You mean the truth
the
process?
The truth process.
Oh,
yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely it was. It was the first time that those of us who were scarred and wounded and demonized and drugged through the mud had a chance to share our story to an audience that would hear it. It was the same thing for people from Morningside Home. By the way, I worked in that community. All of the stuff about we came there and did that. Leader of the Tenants Council was at the march itself before it started. But those children saw people bleeding and dying and their blood soaking in the ground, and nobody came to counsel them. They just sent them to school on Monday as if nothing had happened. They had never had a place to tell their story. So they were able to tell their story, and there was considerable healing. And then Bishop Tutu, who came here twice to help us construct this process, invited us to South Africa. And we were planning to take 10 people. We had to knock it off at 27. All of us went to South Africa. I had dinner at his house and went out to visit where Nelson Mandela was. It was very therapeutic, but the city as a whole has not experienced anything like that. And it is so needed because we are now in the most dangerous period of this nation since the Civil War. Greensboro has an opportunity to stand up and represent a little bit of light out of this thing that we're in. And so we feel all right now, but we feel that unearned suffering has some redemptive power. And actually, if you acknowledge it, take responsibility for it, we together can build a powerful Greensboro. That's our vision. And the city interprets that to mean you can never satisfy them. And in the sense that they are talking about it, it's not valid. It's not valid.
What about the report itself now that it's out there? It's almost 600 pages.
Yes,
it's a report that did document this entire process. the city may be a little slow in adopting it all, but what about the larger use of this? You talked about Greensboro possibly being the shining light on a hill in one of the darkest moments in our history, quite clearly. Is there interest in this now? Do people come to you still and ask you to talk and to spread the word about this process?
There's interest in the people. We had 3 days of activity, and it very much surpassed my expectation. We had 400 people to see a play at A&T. We had around 800 to see a singing. We had around 800 at Bennett. And then we had more than we could get in our church on Sunday. And the stated clerk of the Presbyterian Church USA, Herb Nelson, who's a dear friend of mine, he's the highest position, is the first black man to be there, preached for us last night. We had a healing service. That's where Yvonne spoke. There's a lot of interest in this, and I think the interest is growing because it's beginning to mirror what's becoming normative now in terms of what's happening to people. And all of this work is not in vain. It has not been received or propagated broadly, but the potential for that is there. And we intend to leverage this moment of 40th anniversary to create more discussion and to create more movement. The city would be of enormous help if they would play their role. They said they weren't here 40 years ago. Well, the Baptists who apologized 140 years ago, unless they were 160 years old, they weren't here either. But there's nobody else that can apologize on behalf of the city except those that we have elected and put them in that position, and they need to do it.
Nelson Johnson, a survivor of the Greensboro Massacre, executive director of the Beloved Community Center, and a member of the Greensboro Pulpit Forum, I want to thank you. Also, Valerie Ann Johnson, Mott Distinguished Professor of Women's Studies and director of Africana Women's Studies at Bennett College, also a member of the North Carolina Historical Commission, and Spoma Jovanovic, a professor of Communication Studies at UNC Greensboro, and author of the book Democracy, Dialogue, and Community Action, Truth and Reconciliation in Greensboro. Thank all of you so very much for being
here.
A
correction, please. I'm the co-director of the Beloved Community Center, together with my wife, Joyce, who's sitting over there.
All right. Thank you for that correction. You can find out more about the show and all of our corrections at our website, stateofthings.org. We want to thank you for listening. Today's live music provided by Greensboro-based duo M and Ty, and you can see them perform on November 17th in Winston-Salem at the Old Home Place Vineyard and November 29th at Moxville and Ryland Vineyards. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio. Once again, M and Ty.